The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
They hadn't looked for work since they'd been laid off 6 months earlier, even though they both had new houses and crushing mortgages, and Wyatt had children who would eventually have to get their teeth straightened and go to college. Dave and Wyatt weren't old either. They were still in their late 30s. They had the relevant college degrees. They could have gone out and found something. There were paper companies everywhere, and someone needed to work for them. But Dave and Wyatt didn't even bother looking. It was as though they had lost their will to do something about anything.
You're listening to Stephen Lang reading from Brock Clark's story, The Apology, one of the three tales we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Listen up. The characters in the three stories presented on this program just need someone to pay attention to their wants. Small gestures count for a lot, and strong feelings lie just under the surface in these very different contemporary tales. Our first story, Brock Clark's The Apology, is about two displaced, unemployed Americans who want an apology from the Catholic Church for abuse they suffered as children. Brock Clark's latest book has the wonderfully fanciful title, An Arsonist's Guide to Writers' Homes in New England. Here's our friend Stephen Lang to read The Apology.
Wyatt and Dave were in Wyatt's attached garage, searching for a croquet set Wyatt insisted he had bought once, long ago, and that had to be in the garage somewhere. And while they were looking, they got to talking idly about the weather, baseball, the status of their job searches, and the conversation took a surprising turn or two, and soon Wyatt and Dave discovered that they had both been abused by Catholic priests when they were boys. Once that was out in the open, Wyatt and Dave forgot all about croquet. From the mouth of the garage, they could see their wives, Susan and Rachel, smoking merits under the last remaining mature oak in Shady Oaks, which was the name of their subdivision. Wyatt's two sons were playing a complicated game involving a frisbee, a dog, a detached piece of rusty gutter extension, and someone's hat. They all of a sudden seemed very far away, as if they were someone else's wives and children, as if Wyatt and Dave were very far from the selves they now were. Wyatt could smell the chemicals from the slow-burning charcoal fire he'd set earlier. As was the case with every barbecue he hosted, Wyatt had already made a big speech about cooking with charcoal and not propane. But now that he and Dave had ripped open their chests and revealed their tortured hearts, he felt very far from the man who had been so adamant about the superior taste of ground beef cooked over charcoal, too. As for Dave, he felt something different. His and Rachel's baby son had died just 2 months earlier. He had died of crib death. The doctor had told them that it happened more often than people think. But news of its surprising frequency did not make Dave or Rachel feel any better. The doctor had also asked them if they had put their son to sleep on his stomach or his back. He liked to sleep on his side, Dave said. The doctor had nodded sadly, as if sleeping on one side were the problem, which pretty much ruined what was left of Dave to ruin. Every night, Dave had sneaked into his son's room to watch his son sleep on his side, and in so doing, had begun to feel the blossoming of his own loving, fatherly self. Now that he and Wyatt had told the truth to one another about their abuse, he could start thinking about that and stop thinking about his dead baby. But he didn't say any of this. Instead, he said, "I don't want to be like one of those guys on TV." He was talking about the many other men who'd been sexually abused by Catholic priests in their youths, those legions of sad, wide-eyed men you see on TV who told their stories in public for reasons: money, attention, forgiveness, peace of mind, the well-being of other would-be victims. That seemed mysterious, even to them. No, Dave didn't want to be one of those men. Didn't want what they wanted. "But what do we want?" Wyatt asked. "We want an apology," Dave said. He was right. They simply wanted an apology. So Dave and Wyatt abandoned the garage and set off for St. Anthony's. Rachel and Susan were finishing their cigarettes when they noticed their husbands walking down the street, away from the garage and the smoldering charcoal briquettes, and their chirping children and their smoking wives. "Dave, where are you going?" Rachel asked. "We're going to St. Anthony's." "What for?" "To demand an apology," he said. And then they kept on walking. This was not the first time Dave and Wyatt had demanded an apology. Dave had demanded an apology from his bank for sandbagging him with hidden withdrawal fees. Wyatt had demanded an apology from his children's teachers for making assumptions about how much time Wyatt did or did not spend with his sons going over their homework after school. Dave and Wyatt had both demanded apologies from Lance Paper Company for transferring them from jobs in Utica, New York, and Worcester, Massachusetts, respectively, to Clemson, South Carolina, without giving them a real say in the matter. And then they demanded an apology from their new bosses in South Carolina for laying them off not even 6 months after they'd uprooted themselves and their families. When Dave and Wyatt were done demanding their apologies, they had apologized to their wives for not getting the apologies they felt they deserved, or for getting the apologies and then being disappointed that those apologies didn't make the sun any brighter, or the grass any greener, or their lives any happier. So Dave and Wyatt had demanded other apologies, but this was the first time that they had walked out to demand one. It was a longer walk than they'd reckoned. For one, Dave and Wyatt never walked anywhere anymore, a fact their physicians couldn't say enough about vis-a-vis Dave's and Wyatt's hanging bellies and high blood pressure and diminishing life expectations. And every quarter mile or so, Dave and Wyatt had to pretend to look at a bird or something so that they could stop and catch their breath. For another, Shady Oaks didn't have sidewalks. Plus, theirs was one of those pickup truck subdivisions, and the S-10s roared by all the time, going well above the posted 30-mile-per-hour limit, and sending Dave and Wyatt diving into the open sewers their taxes had been raised for. Wyatt, whose belly was bigger than Dave's and whose blood pressure was higher, even raised the possibility of turning back and just driving to the church in their own S-10s, or maybe just making the trek some other time, when the sun wasn't so high or the heat so oppressive or the traffic so heavy, and when he and Dave were in better physical condition. But Wyatt's suggestion didn't have much conviction behind it, and Dave knew it was just nervousness talking. Because they knew that they were doing what they had to do, and as Dave pointed out, that they were walking instead of driving was a testimony to the seriousness of purpose. Besides, Dave said, there was something biblical and symbolic about their walking, and Wyatt agreed that he couldn't really imagine Moses driving around the desert for 40 years in a detailed truck with running boards and cup holders. They kept walking, It took Dave and Wyatt over an hour before they got to St. Anthony's. In fact, they almost walked right past it, because neither of them was an actual member of the church or had even attended Mass there, and they had really only had a vague idea of where it was located. Besides, it looked nothing like the churches they'd been abused in. Nothing like Sacred Heart in Utica, with its spire reaching up 5 stories and the cross at its peak reaching another story. Nothing like Our Lady of Assumption in Worcester, which was made of native granite and which took up a whole city block and was so grand and massive that it seemed like even God wouldn't be able to destroy it when the day finally came. No, St. Anthony's was more or less a brick ranch house. And they would have missed it entirely had Wyatt not said, "Hey, there's a crucifix over the front door of that brick rancher." And he and Dave turned around, gathered themselves, and then knocked on the church's front door. Who knows why they didn't just go right in instead of knocking? Why is a vampire in the movies unable to enter a house unless he's been invited? Even a vampire wants to feel wanted. They knocked and knocked, and finally a priest opened the door. He wasn't wearing a collar or even those black casual clothes priests wear. He was wearing jeans and flip-flops, and the kind of collarless button-down shirt that makes you think of a rich person on vacation. But Dave and Wyatt knew he was a priest, because, of course, he had answered the church door, but mostly because he looked remarkably like the priests who had abused them. He had a full head of curly reddish-brown hair and a cautious, fatigued smile and raised eyebrows. And Dave and Wyatt both took a step back because the priest looked much like both of their abusers, as though they had summoned those priests to appear before them in a single body. "Can I help you?" the priest asked. His voice was tired, resigned, as if he knew the answer to the question before he even asked it. "Yes," Dave said, and explained how he and Wyatt had been abused by Catholic priests in their youth, and now they wanted an apology. Dave and Wyatt really had been abused. The abuse had run the gamut. Dave had been filleted on retreats, and the same priest had also, more or less innocently and chummily, draped his arm over Dave's shoulders during church school's discussion of the virgin birth, and didn't remove the arm until the lesson was through. Wyatt had been fondled in empty church gyms after CYO basketball games, and the same priest, in front of Wyatt's parents, had simply remarked that Wyatt was a good-looking boy. Dave and Wyatt had been forced to do some things that they couldn't talk about even now, even with each other. They sometimes still woke up in the middle of the night yelling, "It hurts, it hurts," and had to be comforted by Rachel and Susan, who thought their husbands were merely having garden variety nightmares. Wyatt hadn't told Susan about his abuse, but he'd told his 3 previous wives. His first wife had wondered immediately if the abuse had turned Wyatt homosexual, or if it had happened because he had already been homosexual. Wyatt's second wife had used the abuse as a trump card, and if their checking account was empty when it came time to pay the mortgage, or when Wyatt accidentally spilled wine on the white lace tablecloth his second wife had had in her family centuries before they'd immigrated from Donegal, the second wife said, "Don't worry about it, Wyatt. It's nothing compared to what that son of a bitch priest did to you." Then there was Wyatt's third wife, who had been purely supportive when he first told her. She'd said, "It's better that you told me. It can't hurt you anymore. Life will be different now." But their marriage turned out to be something less than the happy, healthy thing she thought it would be. And whenever Wyatt drank too much at dinner parties and took long, loud stands that were somehow both offensive and boring, Or whenever he failed to get the raise or promotion that he felt sure he would get, Wyatt would say, "I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. It's not really my fault." Until finally his third wife accused him of subconsciously using the priest's abuse as an excuse for all his subsequent failures and shortcomings. Wyatt hadn't told Susan, his fourth wife, which seemed to Wyatt the only smart thing he had ever done. Dave hadn't told Rachel either and didn't think he ever would, for exactly the reasons that Wyatt had had four wives to his one, and for exactly the same reason that he never, ever talked about his baby son's death either. In the case of both the abuse and his son's death, Dave was afraid that once the truth was out there in the open, it would be promptly lumped in with other unpleasant truths, and its importance would be diminished. And he was also afraid that it wouldn't be lumped in with all these other truths, that it would dominate the others, and that once it was visible, no one, not even Dave, could ignore it if he wanted to. Dave was afraid, too, that he'd be accused of using his abuse and his son's death as an excuse, and that at some level there would be some truth to the accusation. So Dave told no one about the abuse, and he never talked about his dead son either, not even with Rachel. They instead talked idly. They had so many conversations about the weather that Dave had begun to feel the same way about Rachel that he did about the television weatherwoman. Sometimes she wore clothes that were understated and flattering. Sometimes garish and unbecoming. Sometimes he found her encyclopedic knowledge of tornadoes fascinating, sometimes dull. But he did not feel love for Rachel anymore, which, before their son had died, had been pretty much the only thing he'd felt for her. But at least he didn't talk to her about their dead son. At least she didn't make him admit to his terrible, true feelings that the only thing that mattered anymore about their son was that he was dead. And not once did Dave tell her or anyone else about being abused until he told Wyatt. And then the priest at St. Anthony's. The priest listened, head down, like a man in deep thought or deep regret. And when Dave and Wyatt were done, he said, "I see." And then said, "It doesn't sound like either of you was abused in this church, though." "Even so," Wyatt said, "we'd like an apology." "Can you come back tomorrow?" the priest asked. "Or maybe later in the week?" "No," Dave said. "We've waited 25 years already. We want it now." "Okay," he said. "But I'll have to talk to the bishop first." "He'll have to talk to the cardinal. Lawyers will have to be consulted. It might take a little while." "That's fine," Dave told him. "We have plenty of time." And it was true that Dave and Wyatt had plenty of time. They could have waited there all night and into the morning for their apology, because even though the next day was Monday, Dave and Wyatt had no jobs to go to. They hadn't looked for work since they'd been laid off 6 months earlier, even though they both had new houses and crushing mortgages, and Wyatt had children who would eventually have to get their teeth straightened and go to college. Dave and Wyatt weren't old, either. They were still in their late 30s. They had the relevant college degrees. They could have gone out and found something. There were paper companies everywhere, and someone needed to work for them. But Dave and Wyatt didn't even bother looking. It was as though they had lost their will to do something about anything. It wasn't that they were lazy, exactly. It was that They felt that being ambitious wouldn't amount to much. Besides, Wyatt had the kind of oversized garage designed to accommodate the speedboat Wyatt talked about buying but knew he never would. Wyatt and Dave liked to set up folding chairs in the garage and leave the country music channel playing softly on the transistor radio and not talk and watch Wyatt's grass seed wash away in the warm monsoonal spring rains. The rain made a nice, fat, bunging sound on the garage's tin roof. It was comfortable in the garage, safe. Why would they want to go and look for work when they could stay in the garage? Wyatt's and Dave's abuse at the hands of their priests might have had nothing to do with this lethargy. This was yet another thing they were afraid of, that they wouldn't know what was the product of abuse or what was simply part and parcel of being a normal 38-year-old American man, disgruntled and living far away from his true home with no job, not even one he disliked. They would never know what was connected to the abuse and what was not. They would never be sure. This was another thing they would demand an apology for. The priest made them wait in the church basement. Wyatt griped about this at first. The basement was carpeted, and the carpet smelled of something wet and long dead. And the glaring overhead fluorescent light kept flickering. And if it were to go out, Dave and Wyatt would be in complete darkness because there were no windows and no other lights that they could see. Wyatt said, "After all we've been through, we deserve better than to be stuck in a church basement." Wyatt hadn't been in a church in ages and spoke longingly of the seed-oiled wood pews, the stained glass, the votive candles, the towering pipe organ, the holy water, the veined marble pulpit, and the stations of the cross. "I wouldn't mind waiting so much," Wyatt said, "if we could only wait in the church itself." But Dave said, "No, it's better that we wait in the basement. It's better this way." And the subject was dropped. They waited. They waited a very long time. They did not speak to each other. Wyatt breathed heavily through his nose, then began whistling in the distracted manner of a person unaccustomed to introspection. Dave was crying softly, so softly that Wyatt couldn't hear it over the white noise of his nose breathing and whistling. Dave was crying because he had started thinking about the apology, how satisfying it would be to get it finally after all these years, and how maybe he could then forget about the priest, the retreats, everything. And maybe once the apology was tendered, he could then start living his life. And then he realized that he had never asked anyone to apologize for his son's death. It had simply never occurred to him. He had demanded apologies from everyone and for everything imaginable, and yet he had not demanded one for what had happened to his son. It was yet another way he had failed his son. He had failed to keep his son alive, and he had failed to demand an apology for his death. This was why he was crying. He cried for what seemed like hours until the crying exhausted itself. You couldn't cry forever. Dave knew this from experience, and once you stopped crying, you had to do the only thing you were capable of doing. The only thing Dave was capable of doing was to wait for the priest's apology, and that apology would have to double for the apology he should have gotten for his son. Just then, Wyatt and Dave heard voices. The basement door opened. There was the sound of someone walking down the stairs. They both rose to their feet without realizing that they had risen to their feet. They expected it to be the priest, of course, apology in hand. But it was just Rachel and Susan, their wives. Wyatt was glad to see Susan, because he had begun to think his and Dave's mission was a big mistake. They had begun the quest for their apology together, on the same page. But they were not on that same page anymore. There was something about Dave's gloominess Wyatt could not penetrate. Wyatt knew about Dave's son, of course, and was very grateful that nothing bad had happened to any of his three boys. But he had not realized until now how much greater Dave's pain was than his. It had not occurred to Wyatt that all pain is not equal, and that one's pain didn't give one a greater insight into someone else's. Dave's and Wyatt's abuse had brought them together, but it could not do so completely or forever. And so, while Wyatt felt sorry for his friend, his best friend, he also felt estranged. As for Dave, he wasn't thinking about Wyatt now. He was thinking about Rachel. How beautiful she was, with her hair swept back in the messy ponytail that would always make her look like a 20-year-old girl just back from the beach. How she was much too lovely to be in this musty basement. How her beauty didn't make him feel any better, and in fact made him even more sad, because the beauty didn't matter to him anymore. And how he wanted her to leave immediately. "What are you doing here?" Dave asked them. "We're here to get both of you to come home," Susan said. "The kids are waiting in the van. We saved some hamburgers for you back home." "Is the priest up there?" Dave asked. "Yes," Rachel said. "What's he doing?" "He's just sitting in a pew, staring into space. When we asked him where you were, he put his face in his hands and said, 'Basement.'" "He seemed a little freaked out," Susan said. "Good," Dave said. "Dave," Rachel said, "what are you doing here?" Dave shot a look at Wyatt, who sighed his big man sigh and nodded, and so Dave told the story. He spoke for himself and for Wyatt, looking at his feet the whole time. When he was done telling the story, he didn't look up. "I'm sorry," Wyatt said to Susan. He knew his history and could see the end of their marriage looming in the distance like an abandoned factory. Susan shrugged and said, "That's okay," because she was more than a decade younger than Wyatt, and her generation was relatively comfortable talking publicly about the bad things that had been done to them. "No big deal," she said. "I still love you." "Do you know what I hate?" Rachel said to Dave. "What?" Dave said. But she didn't answer him back until he lifted his head to look at her. "I hate when I tell people that Nick died of crib death and they ask, 'Where did it happen?'" Dave smiled then. He really did. But when Rachel said, "I want you to come home," he shook his head and the smile disappeared and he said, "No, I'm going to wait for this apology." "I miss him too," she said. "And I'm truly sorry about what that priest did to you, but I want you to come home." "I can't," he'd said. "I wish you'd come home with me right now," she said, very slowly, as if speaking to someone addled or retarded. because I don't think I'm coming back to get you." They looked at each other for a while, their gazes steady, unblinking. It was the way people stare at each other, not when they're in love, but afterward, when they finally realize all the many horrible and beautiful things locked up within that love. But Dave didn't move, and Rachel finally broke the eye lock and ran up the stairs two at a time. Wyatt was on his feet. He was already thinking of how lucky he was to have this younger fourth wife and his spacious garage and his kids. And suddenly the apology didn't seem so urgent anymore. He had waited so long. He could certainly wait a little longer. And even if Wyatt never got his apology, then maybe that was all right too. It seemed to him that he had gotten what he wanted somehow without getting what he wanted. And he marveled to himself about how resilient the human animal is and thought that he might even work on his resume when he got home, maybe check the employment ads in the morning. "I'm going home, buddy," he said to Dave. "You should too." Dave shook his head. "It's all right," he said. "I'll catch up with you later." They shook hands then. Wyatt took Susan's, and they walked up the stairs, closing the door behind them. When they were gone, Dave turned off the light and lay down on the rug. He was thinking of the future. His wife and friends were gone. It was undoubtedly too dark to walk home, and besides, he didn't want to go there anyway. But maybe he could stay in the basement. It wasn't as nice as Wyatt's garage, but overall, it didn't seem such a bad place to stay. There was an old Frigidaire humming in the corner. There was a bathroom with an exhaust fan. He could conceivably stay in there forever. Maybe he would ask the priest if that were possible. Maybe he could attach it as a rider to his apology. Dave fell asleep, rolling over on his side in the fashion of his dead son, and his last thought before falling asleep was that he would waive his demand for apology if God would just let him die in his sleep, just as God had let his son die in his sleep, just as God had let so many other things happen. But Dave didn't die in his sleep. He woke up when he heard a door open at the top of the stairway. He got up and walked to the foot of the stairs. The priest was standing there, illuminated from above by the chandelier in the vestibule. The priest saw Dave, but he didn't move, and neither did Dave. It seemed possible that they would stand staring at each other forever, and that was fine with Dave, because there was nothing left for him to do but wait for his apology, which was the only thing standing between the life he had lived up until now and the life to come.
Stephen Lang read Brock Clark's story, The Apology. We had fun creating a selected shorts evening focused on workplace shenanigans, office comedy and drama. Joshua Ferris's The Chairs tells a complex and harrowing cautionary tale. It's a piece from his novel, Then We Came to the End. It's read for us by the singer, actress, and Thalia Follies political cabaret star, Ivy Austin.
Someone passed around a link once to a news article posted on a reputable website that we all read and talked about for days. A man working at an office much like ours had a heart attack at his desk, and for the rest of the day, people passing by his workstation failed to notice. That wasn't the newsworthy bit. There are, 150 million of us in the workplace? It was bound to happen to somebody. What we couldn't wrap our heads around, what made this man's commonplace death national news, was the unlikely information provided in the first sentence of the dispatch. A man working in an Arlington, Virginia insurance firm died of a heart attack at his desk recently and wasn't discovered until 4 days later when co-workers complained of a bad fruit smell. The article went on to explain that Friday had passed and then the weekend, and no one had discovered this man fallen in his cubicle. Not a co-worker, not a building guy, not someone collecting the trash. Then we were supposed to believe that Monday came around. Monday, with its meetings and returned phone calls, its resumption of routine and reinstatement of duty. Monday came and went, and they didn't find him then either. It wasn't until Tuesday afternoon, when they all went in search of a rotten banana, that they saw one of their own dead on the floor by his desk, obscured by his chair. We kept asking ourselves, how could that be possible? Surely someone had to come by with a request for a meeting. Someone had to come by to inquire why a meeting was missed. But no. This poor jerk was the subject of not so much as a morning greeting from one of his cube neighbors. We didn't know how this could happen. We hated not knowing something. We hated not knowing who was next to walk Spanish down the hall. How would our bills get paid? And where would we find new work? Oh, we knew the power of the credit card companies and the collection agencies and the consequences of bankruptcy. Those institutions were without appeal. They put your name into a system, and from that point forward, vital parts of the American dream were foreclosed upon. A backyard swimming pool, a long weekend in Vegas, a low-end BMW. These were not Jeffersonian ideals. Perhaps on par with life and liberty, but at this advanced stage, with the West won and the Cold War over, they too seemed among our inalienable rights. This was just before the fall of the dollar, before the stormy debate about corporate outsourcing and the specter of a juggernaut of Chinese and Indian youths overtaking our advantages in broadband. Marcia hated not knowing what might come of being caught with Tom Moda's chair, with its serial numbers that would not match up with the office coordinator's master list. So she swapped Tom's chair for Ernie's and left Tom's in Tom's old office. Even so, she was still scared that the office coordinator would look for Ernie's chair in Ernie's old office, from which Chris Yop had taken it, swapping it with his own lesser chair when Ernie retired, and discover not Ernie's serial numbers, but Chris Yop's. And upon that discovery, go in search of Ernie's chair, which Marcia was presently sitting on. Sooner or later, Marcia feared, the office coordinator was bound to find out what she had done. So she felt the need to get her original chair back from Karen Wu, who had received it some months prior when Marcia took Reiser's chair. When Reiser offered it to her after taking Sean Smith's chair after Sean got canned, she went to Karen to ask for her chair back. But Karen didn't want to part with her chair, which she claimed wasn't the one Marcia had given her at all, but was Bob Yagley's chair, which she had swapped with Marcia's late one night after gentle, soft-spoken Bob was let go. Bob's old office was currently occupied by a woman named Dana Reddick, who had made the leap from cubicle to office less by virtue of merit than by management's perception that so many vacated offices looked bad to potential visitors. When Dana made that leap, she brought along her own chair, which had once belonged to someone in account management, and was a better chair than Bob's, which was really Marcia's. "What was wrong with my chair?" Marcia asked her. Dana replied that nothing was wrong with it, per se. She had just gotten attached to the account management person's chair. "So where is my chair, then?" asked Marcia. Dana told her it was probably in the same place she had left it, Dana's old cubicle. But when she and Marcia walked down to that particular workstation, they found some production person fresh out of college. He looked all at 15, where Dana used to sit, who told them that somebody a few months back had passed down the hall only to return, pull rank, and take his chair, which was replaced by the cheap plastic thing he'd been sitting on ever since. All attempts to get the fresh-faced peon to pony up a little information on who had strong-armed him out of his chair were for naught, until Marcia asked him point-blank how he expected to get out of production hell and make it to assistant art director if he couldn't even sketch a face on a legal pad. So the production kid made a rough sketch from memory of the man who took his chair. And when he was through filling in the hair and putting the final touches on the eyes, Marcia and Dana examined it and determined it was a dead ringer for Chris Yop. Was it possible that Yop had grown bored with Ernie Kessler's chair, walked past a chair he liked better and bullied it out from under a production nobody, and walked away with Marcia's chair, which he sat on until the office coordinator came around giving him heat and he found himself without any alternative but to take it down to Tom's office and pretend it was Tom's, so that when Marcia went in to swap Tom's real chair with Ernie Kessler's, it wasn't Ernie's chair at all, but Marcia's original one that she took back with her? Did Marcia have her own chair again? Are you absolutely sure that this is the guy who took your chair? She asked the production peon. The production peon said no. He wasn't sure of that at all. Marcia had no idea whose chair she had. It might have been hers, it might have been Ernie Kessler's, or it might have been the chair of some indeterminate third party. The only person who knew for certain was the office coordinator, who owned the master list. Marcia returned to her office, beset by the high anxiety typical of the time.
Ivy Austin read Joshua Ferris's The Chairs. After a short break, we'll be back with a story read by B.D. Wong. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. We complete this program with George Garrett's Feeling Good, Feeling Fine. George Garrett is the author of 27 books and the editor of 17 others. In this story, Garrett pulls off the deft and amazing narrative feat of letting us know what will happen to these people years from now in the future, while capturing a memorable portrait of them at a present moment when they cannot know what is coming and we do. This poignant and unsettling short story is read for us by the stage and television actor B.D. Wong.
A boy and a man in the park. Between them, an old wooden bat, a battered and dirty baseball, and one leather glove. Well tended and cared for, oiled and supple, but old too, its pocket as thin as paper. The boy and the man are sweating in the late afternoon light. Lazy end of a long summer day. The park, no more than a rough grass field, really, is empty now, except for the two of them. Somewhere not far away, a car horn toots, a dog barks. A woman calls her children in for supper. "Come on!" the man shouts. "Knock it to me!" The boy, carefully, all concentration, tosses the ball up and swings the bat to loft it high above the man, who, skinny and raggedy as a scarecrow, moves gracefully back and away and underneath the high fly ball, spears it deftly with the glove, then throws it high and easy back toward the boy. The ball rolls dead, in easy reach from his feet. "Let's quit and go home," the boy calls. The tall, thin man shakes his head and moves back deeper. "One more," he hollers. "Just one more." Crack of the bat on the ball, and this is the best one yet. A home run ball high in the fading light, almost lost in the last blue of the sky. The man shading his eyes as he runs smoothly and swiftly back and back until he's there where he has to be to snag it. Snags it. Then comes running in toward the boy, hugely grinning, a loping fielder who has made the final catch of the inning. You might think the boy would be pleased to have swung his bat, the glove and the bat and the ball are his, that well, and knocked the ball so high and far. But the truth is, the boy hates baseball. "It's my least favorite sport," he will tell anyone who asks, anyone except the man running toward him, his uncle, his mother's brother, who has recently come to live with them after several years at the state hospital. Uncle Jack, he's had a hard time of it. First time he went crazy, his wife ran off with their two daughters, the boy's cousins, to California or someplace like that and disappeared for keeps. Boy doesn't know it, can't comprehend it, even if he could imagine it, but he won't ever see that woman and his two cousins again. Uncle Jack is living with them for the time being, until he has a chance to get things straightened out, the boy's father explains. When the boy complains about the hours spent, wasted as far as he's concerned, knocking fungos and chasing flies and grounders with Uncle Jack, his father simply says, "Humor him, boy. He's good at it. Let him be." He ain't that good, the boy sometimes thinks, but doesn't say. Said it once, though, and his father corrected him. "Listen, boy, he's rusty. He hasn't been well, but believe me, I'm here to tell you, he was some kind of a baseball player, a real pleasure to watch." "Minor league," the boy said scornfully. who can't imagine anyone settling for anything less than the top of the heap. If he liked baseball enough to want to play at it, he would be in the majors or nothing. He sure enough wouldn't be happy with some old photographs in an album, some frail, yellowing newspaper clippings. And if he was a crazy old man back from the state hospital and had a nephew who was required to humor him, the boy would never pretend, let alone believe for one minute, that he was getting himself back in shape so he could join the New York Yankees or the Washington Senators or somebody like that. Uncle Jack couldn't even play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Uncle Jack now has the bat in one hand and the other arm around the boy's shoulders. The boy carries the glove and the ball as the two of them slowly head for home in the twilight. "You hit that last one just a hell of a good lick," Uncle Jack says. "You could be a real hitter if you put your mind to it. It's all in the coordination, and you have got that, all you could ever need." Why, if he hates baseball, does the boy relish and rejoice in the man's words? Why, if his Uncle Jack is some kind of crazy person and is fooling himself and everybody else too about what a great ball player he was and thinks he still is, why does the boy automatically accept and enjoy his uncle's judgment? Why, if his uncle is mostly embarrassment and trouble, someone to be ashamed of, does the boy at this very instant, altogether in spite of himself, wish more than anything that the tall, thin, raggedy, graceful man was and is everything he ought to be or could have been? Years and years later, when this boy is a grandfather himself, for reasons he won't understand then any more than he does now, he will tell his grandchildren and anyone else who will bother to listen to him all about his Uncle Jack, who was briefly, but is not all beauty and great achievement as brief as the flare of a struck match, a wonderful athlete, a baseball player much admired and envied by his peers, someone who, except for a piece or two of bad luck, would have been named and honored among the very best of them, someone to be proud of, someone who once tried to teach him how to play the game. They're close to home now. They have left the raw, wide field behind and are coming up under the dark canopy of shade. Houses with green, crisp lawns, dark earth, and here and there a sprinkler pulsing bright water. Can see the lights of the boy's house being switched on downstairs. Can hear briefly before his father's voice calls out in a crisp command, music playing loudly on the radio. That will be his sister or his little brother fooling around. Upstairs, probably. They are almost close enough to see through the lighted windows of the dining room his mother and Hattie, the maid, who works late and long for them in this Great Depression, setting the supper table with flat silver napkins and water glasses. For a little time, the short walk, more of a stroll into the gradual dark, he has been almost perfectly content. Weary, sweated out, but feeling good, feeling fine. Soothed by his uncle's complimentary words. Suddenly confident that whatever he does from here and now to the end of his life will go well. Even more, that he will be able not only to enjoy this feeling of satisfaction, of joy, really, but will be able to share it with others less fortunate than himself. What he cannot know, even as he and his uncle come across the lawn and into the house and shut the front door behind him, what he can't know and will not choose even to remember years and years later when he bitterly rakes the ashes of his life, searching for even one remaining glowing coal, is what happens next. At the table, his father, who includes the whole family, even Hattie, in almost everything, will tell them about the long-distance telephone call he received at his office this same afternoon from a doctor at the state hospital in Chattahoochee. The doctor has told him that there's a new kind of an operation on the brain that might, just might, cure Uncle Jack for good and all. No more coming and going, no more breakdowns and slow recoveries. It is a new thing. There can be no promises or guarantees, of course, and as in any operation, there's always danger, there are always risks, But everybody listens intently. Everybody except Hattie, who elects to go back into the kitchen quietly. Everybody listens. And then before Jack or anyone can say anything, his mother bursts into tears, sobs at the table, trying to hide her face with her hands, her shoulders shaking. Later that evening, the boy will see his father for the first and probably the only time, slap his mother full across her soft face, making her sob again and more as they quarrel about what may be the best thing for her brother to do. His uncle will settle the quarrel by freely and cheerfully choosing to return to the hospital to undergo this operation. And the boy and man would warn them then and now if there was some way, any way, if only he could. It went badly. As badly as can be, leaving his uncle no more than half alive, a vegetable, really, in that hospital for the rest of his life. The boy will live to be an old man, will go to war and live through it, will learn all the lessons of love and death, of gain and loss, of pride and of regret a long life can teach. But none of this has happened yet. Man and boy have spent a long afternoon in the park together, and at the end of it, have come home. They come in the front door. Jack grabs his sister, the boy's mother, and gives her a bear hug, lifts her in the air. The boy goes to put the bat and the ball and the glove in the hall closet. Over his shoulder, he hears his sister and brother coming down the stairs like a pair of wild ponies. Looking up, turning, he sees his father, smiling in shirt sleeves, coming out of the living room with the evening paper in his hands. "Here they are," he says. "Here come our baseball players. Just in time for supper."
George Garrett's story, Feeling Good, Feeling Fine, read by B.D. Wong. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.